Hey, welcome back to Politico Tech. It's Wednesday, May 1st. I'm Stephen Overly. Jacob Hellberg has been called TikTok's opponent, TikTok's nemesis. That's because he was an influential voice behind the recent law that forces the app to find a new owner or be banned in the U.S. It's a role that Jacob traces back to a book he wrote almost 3 years ago,
called The Wires of War, Technology and the Global Struggle for Power, which got quite a bit of attention in the halls of Congress.
Former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy was a fan, Jacob says. McCarthy then put him on a commission that advises Congress on Chinese threats. And then the TikTok bill put him in the middle of Washington's biggest geopolitical rivalry. Jacob is now focusing on what he sees as the next national security risk: competition with China over AI.
And I worry that too many of our policymakers are planning, you know, are building an exquisite Maginot line instead of building the weapons of the future.
Now, there's a big disclosure here. Jacob is also a senior advisor to the CEO of Palantir, a big defense contractor that would surely profit if Washington becomes fixated on AI warfare. Still, he's made inroads. Today, Jacob is a lead organizer of the Hill and Valley Forum, a DC conference that will pull together lawmakers, national security officials, and AI leaders. I sat down with him yesterday in his palatial hotel suite to talk about the next frontier of tech competition with China. Here's our conversation. Thanks for joining us on Politico Tech.
Thanks for having me.
I was going to ask you sort of a chicken and egg style question, right? Which is, you know, for you, you know, were you sort of a China hawk first, or did you home in on these TikTok threats first?
So I was an American first, and part of that experience stemmed from, my mom is from France, my dad is from Ohio, his parents were Holocaust survivors, my mother's parents fled Tunisia when Tunisia became independent. And it's through that personal experience that I developed a worldview that I guess you could say is very anti-authoritarian and skeptical of authoritarian regimes in general. In more recent years, we've seen the Chinese government embark on a series of legislative reforms that have completely erased the dividing line between the public and the private sector. And that has had profound systemic repercussions on how we need to think about our technology trading relationships with China. And ultimately, TikTok, in my view, was a bellwether for whether and how we are committed to rethinking that relationship as a country. And I'm incredibly encouraged that the Congress answered overwhelmingly that the answer is yes.
TikTok has said they will sue. Some folks have said they may have a compelling argument, whether that's First Amendment or some other kind of constitutional violation. Are you doing any work now on sort of the legal fight and sort of trying to now get this law through the courts?
So the work on the legal fight was actually undertaken when the bill was written. So the bill was written with help of the White House counsel. I can't emphasize enough the amount of care that has gone into crafting this bill in a way that is actually incredibly well thought through from a legal standpoint, and in my view, unassailable. The First Amendment concerns will not hold water in court.
Why not?
We take actions against companies on grounds of national security all the time in this country. I think in our common law system, the why a law is passed actually matters. In this particular case, the law isn't about the speech that's on TikTok. It's about the behavior and the conduct of the app and the corporate ownership structure of the app. It has nothing to do with the speech. And so if you argue that there's a First Amendment concern, you could extrapolate that argument to questioning, you know, is it the right thing for us to take actions, sanctions on Russian oil companies, on Russian telecommunication companies? And yet we do this all the time. We had a long history of putting restrictions on the foreign ownership of traditional media in this country. And in many ways, it was an anomaly that we had this weird carve out for social media, even though most people get the vast majority of their news today through social media, not traditional news. And so I think there's so many different angles in which the First Amendment argument doesn't actually hold any water. And so I'm not terribly concerned. I think it'll actually get tossed out of the courts really fast.
I've been credited kind of rallying support for this move in Silicon Valley. And there are some critics who say, you know, ultimately this effort eliminates a competitor to Meta or to Google. What do you say to that when you hear that criticism?
Well, I think that would be true if they would be allowed to purchase it, but there's just no way a Republican or Democratic administration at this point will allow Google or Meta to purchase TikTok. So whoever TikTok will be purchased by, it won't be those two companies. So hopefully if we can go through an orderly divestiture, TikTok will continue to exist and it will not be owned by Meta or Google.
Do you think
it could be owned by Elon Musk? Who knows?
Elon Musk, that could be. I mean, he's maybe he's looking.
Conservatives will like that more than Democrats, but
I'm sure they would.
He has the capital.
Do you know if Elon Musk is interested? Has he talked to you?
No, I haven't talked to him.
Okay, I have to ask since you posited that. Now that this bill has been passed, it has been signed. What's your next target?
So I am incredibly interested in artificial intelligence, particularly as it relates to national security. I think we are at a major inflection point. Technology is advancing and accelerating on every front right now in the private sector. And the big trillion-dollar question for our country is whether we can take those private innovations and convert them into hard power. If the answer is yes, I think we'll be able to maintain our military deterrence and keep the peace internationally. If the answer is no, I worry that our deterrence will erode and we will see more instability and acts of aggression around the world. And I think a big part of where that answer will land will hinge on our ability to lead in artificial intelligence. And I'm a little bit concerned that a lot of people in Washington have been very interested in AI lately, but there have been so many issues in artificial intelligence that have been touched upon that I worry that national security has become diluted in that discussion. And so part of my goal for hosting the Hill and Valley Forum on AI security is actually to elevate national security as an issue in the AI policy debate, because I believe it should be the organizing principle for how we think about AI governance and policy.
And what's your case there? Why is that being overlooked right now? And what should people in Washington be focused on?
Well, I think it's being overlooked in the sense that my basic two-pronged approach is we have two priorities as a country that are absolutely foundational. On the one hand, we need to have the best military AI in the world if we want to maintain and uphold our country's security, because we're not going to be able to address any of the other issues in AI, from the future of work to AI bias and discrimination, if we're not able to defend our country's security. And number two, we can't defend our country's security either if we can't stop China from getting access to our most sensitive AI capabilities. So on the one hand, I think we need national security safeguards to stop China, terrorist groups, and our adversaries from getting access to our most advanced AI capabilities. And while on the other hand, we need to make sure that those safeguards don't stifle the innovation that we need in order to have the best capabilities out there.
Well, I want to acknowledge your day-to-day. You work for Palantir, which is a government contractor looking to do this work with AI in the government space. I mean, what are the safety parameters and guardrails that need to be put on AI for it to be effective for national security? Because that is sort of the big question right now, is how do you keep AI from running amok and causing all sorts of problems, including, you know, in the geopolitical space?
Yeah, well, that's such an important question. When you think about AI in defense and the military, there's fundamentally a trade-off between speed and human control. So the more automation you have, the faster your systems will go. You can compress windows, things that used to take days and weeks, you'll be able to do in minutes and potentially seconds with AI, which is amazing. And sometimes can make a huge difference when you're fighting a war in real time. With that being said, if you automate too much, you inherently lose human control And sometimes you want humans to be in control because you want humans to make the ultimate decision about whether or not to press on the button and so forth. And ultimately, we just need to have those discussions with policymakers to kind of iron out the details about what the right balance is relative to what our adversaries are doing and what we're comfortable with as a democracy.
Congress right now is weighing AI regulation. What are you advocating that they do?
Well, I want to be respectful of their process and the discussions they've already undertaken. With that being said, my basic viewpoint is I would encourage every senator and member of Congress to really think through national security as the overriding priority for how we should think about artificial intelligence and how AI as a technology should be governed from a policy standpoint.
We do hear this from industry a lot where, you know, you shouldn't regulate this space because we need to be the leader in the world for national security reasons, and any regulation will kind of handcuff tech companies. Is that the argument that you're making?
Well, I'm in favor of national security safeguards. So right now there are no rules stopping any given AI company from setting up an AI lab in China, for example, for X, Y, or Z reason, and the Chinese getting access to the source code of that AI. I think that's wrong. We already have rules around national security that restrict the export of sensitive military technologies. AI is arguably the most foundational dual-use technology out there. And so I'm actually completely in favor of rules. I don't have the answer to what those rules are, but what I do know is we do need rules that make it harder for the Chinese and our adversaries, including terrorist groups, from getting access to our most sensitive stuff. Now, some of those rules might be making it harder, but not impossible. It's very hard to make something completely impossible, but you know, at least we need rules that make it substantially harder and don't leave the door completely wide open to our adversaries, because our security depends on us being ahead. It's not good enough to be at parity. Parity means we've already lost. And so we have to stay ahead if we're going to stay safe and keep the peace. And I think Americans really need to understand that, you know, if something really went sideways with China, it would be a drastically different kind of war than anything we've ever experienced. The last thing I'll say is it's been about 80 years since the US and the world last fought a great power war. That's the same amount of time that elapsed between the American Civil War and World War II. And if you just think about how profoundly different those two worlds were in terms of the World War II had planes, it had bombs, it had, you know, missiles and so forth. The Civil War didn't have any of that. And it was a totally different world. I mean, people were still using the telegraph. And so I think today it's really important to think about the fact that if a war were to break out, it would be entirely new and it would not look at all like World War II. And I worry that too many of our policymakers are building an exquisite Maginot line instead of building the weapons of the future. As someone who wants peace, I consider myself not a hawk because I think peace just comes through deterrence. I think it's really important that we continue to have the best military.
Working for a defense contractor and wanting peace feels incompatible, but I guess your point there is strong defense equals deterrence equals peace.
Well, I would argue that the more you have the best defense, the less you'll ever have to use it. And that in history, the cost of being weak has always been higher than the cost of being strong. And so that's my basic viewpoint. And look, to be fair, I've actually had this view long before I joined Palantir. So, you know, obviously joining Palantir, you know, you're right to point out that, you know, I'm obviously biased because I work for Palantir, which does business with the DoD. With that being said, I think it's also fair to say that I've had these views for a very long time and have been very loud and proud about my basic belief. I actually joined Palantir because I had these views, not the other way around.
Is there legislation out there being discussed now that you think would accomplish that? Or is that bill yet to be written?
I think it's still too early days, to be honest. It's very, very early in the AI policy debate, in my view. Based on my conversations with a number of elected officials, they're still very much ramping up on that. With a handful of exceptions who are already very well read on this, a lot of policymakers are still kind of wrapping their minds around, you know, AI has been such a buzzword, but what does it mean in concrete ways? And everyone conceptually understands that AI is going to change the future of the military, but I think helping them understand in very practical terms, what does that mean? You know, what will a future AI-enabled military look like? I think is something that a lot of elected officials will probably ramp up on in the weeks and months ahead.
How fast do you think they need to move on that?
You know, it's hard to say that in an election year because I'm not very optimistic that much will happen this Congress. I think the remainder of this Congress will really most likely be focused on the educational piece because I just can't see a major AI bill pass between now and the election. So we'll see.
Right. You know, you made a comment earlier about how in China, kind of the lines between government and private sector have blurred, especially around tech and the national security concerns that that raises. At the same time, you've also seemed to be, you know, in favor of the U.S. government working more closely with industry, especially on things like AI. Where is the appropriate line for sort of civil military fusion? Because I think some folks could look at that and see a double standard.
Well, here, I mean, civil military fusion basically means that the Chinese government has completely subjugated and instrumentalized its, you know, Chinese companies relative to the Chinese state. So first of all, I sit on a bipartisan commission called the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. One of the findings from the many congressional hearings that we've hosted is that there is no such thing as a private company in China. The public sector has completely absorbed the private sector into a state where Chinese companies have now effectively a dual mandate. They have a commercial mandate and a political mandate. In our system, you can have collaboration, but it's still entirely voluntary. And that's a very different paradigm because it means that, for example, if you imagine collaboration between a company like, say, Google and the Pentagon, you know, they're going to collaborate on some things, but Google's going to push back on others, as we've seen. And so it's just a very different dynamic. And I'm ultimately in favor of collaboration between our best companies and the government, which is why I started the Hill and Valley Forum. I think it's the whole foundation of American power will be based on the relationship between Silicon Valley and Capitol Hill. I think for a long time, tech companies in the Bay Area saw relations between the US and China deteriorate and try to navigate that landscape by staying neutral. But in practice, neutrality meant being equidistant between Washington and Beijing and caused them to actually accept a lot of different moral compromises and over time, you know, operate through a one company, two systems model, which I believed was bound to fail. And I think, you know, when I look back at where we were at the first Hill and Valley Forum and where we are today, I think it's fair to say that Silicon Valley's era of neutrality is over. And I find it exciting that we have now reached a milestone where, and a turning point, where more and more people in Silicon Valley are ready to take a side and be on America's side. And that's one of the messages that I hope shines through this year's Hill and Valley Forum.
You know, I've covered tech and trade in my career, and in recent years, hear a lot more kind of this argument or discussion point that U.S. policy has drifted much closer to Chinese policy when it comes to export restrictions, investment restrictions, you know, some of these questions about industry government partnership. Is the U.S. effectively now trying to beat China using its own playbook?
I don't think that's true. I think what makes the U.S. different than China is the fact that we're a democracy. We have a free press. We have a separation of powers between an independent judiciary, a legislative branch, an executive branch. And so, you know, when American democracy has never been perfect, when there have been excesses, we have had big contentious debates in our very raucous press. I think that is fundamentally what makes America America and what makes China an autocracy is they don't have this separation of powers or free press and so forth. I think the fact that we use export controls to protect ourselves or, you know, even decide that some industries are strategic and that we want to incentivize, I don't view that as being inherently Chinese. In fact, Alexander Hamilton wrote the report on the manufacturers, which was basically an industrial policy document, which dates back to the very genesis of our country. Yeah. So I think in a lot of ways, you know, what makes America America is really a set of a political system, you know, more than a given rule coming out of the Commerce Department.
Well, Jacob, thanks for joining us on Politico Tech.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. See you back here tomorrow.